Good morning. Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFollette. On a show this week, I'll be talking to Philip Martin, professor of agriculture and resource economics at the University of California, Davis, and our topic will be migrant workers. Philip, glad to have you on the show.
It's nice to be here.
Well, we're going to be talking about migrant workers. Maybe it'd be helpful for you to begin by explaining who falls under the rubric of migrant workers.
Well, a migrant is someone who leaves one area and moves to another area. So within the United States, one definition of migrant is a person who leaves one county and moves to another county. Internationally, it's a person who leaves the country in which they were born or the country in which they're a citizen and moves to another country. So there are many, many different definitions of migrant, but all of the definitions convey the idea of leaving one place and moving to another place.
Okay, and I assume then that leaves open whether the person is coming in to stay in the new place or whether they're just coming there for a short bit of time and then going back home.
All the definitions vary. The United Nations definition says that a person has to be away from their usual country of birth or citizenship for at least 12 months to be considered a migrant. Many of the other definitions, such as the definition of a migrant farm worker within the United States, says that a worker has to be away from his or her usual place overnight. So one night away is enough to make someone a migrant farm worker. So depending on the definition, you can generate quite different numbers and profiles of migrants.
Well, maybe we'll even talk a little bit about how the different definitions affect the understanding of migrant workers. What are you going to be using sort of as the base definition for the remainder of the show?
Well, when we talk international migrants, we'll use the UN definition. When we talk U.S. migrants, we will learn that there is no single federal definition. Instead, there are about 12 different definitions of migrant farm worker, each established to determine eligibility for a particular program. And we'll try to be careful at indicating exactly what definition we're using.
Well, now, how many people in the U.S. would fit into one of these definitions or the other? How many would be considered migrant workers using either the U.N. or some of the internal definitions?
We don't have a very good overall feel for migrants within the United States using the U.N. definition. We know that about 16% of Americans change their residence every year, and that means over five-year period, over half of Americans change their residence. Most move within a county, some move across county lines, and some move across state lines. But normally what we have focused on in the United States are people who migrate across county and state lines in order to do farm work. So migrant has almost become synonymous with farm work, even though it is true that under any of the migrant farm worker definitions, there are far more non-farm migrant workers than there are migrant farm workers. For example, almost everyone involved in the travel industry would be a migrant because people involved in airlines or buses or trains typically do stay away from home overnight in order to do their jobs. So there are many, many non-farm migrants, from traveling salespeople to soldiers. But we normally focus on a particular group of workers, migrant farm workers, and they move in order to do work on farms for wages.
So for a variety of very practical reasons, probably, we have focused on migrant farm workers. Could you say a little bit about the citizenship or the characteristics of people that fall under the rubric of migrant workers more generally?
Well, let's go back and perhaps put a little perspective on this. Agriculture was the largest single industry in the United States for most of U.S. history. The number of farms and farm workers peaked in the mid-1930s during the Great Depression. And as late as the beginning of World War II, about one-fourth of U.S. workers were employed in agriculture. The number of people employed in agriculture, both as farmers and farm workers, started decreasing, especially after World War II, when there was a big rural-urban migration. And what happened was that during the 1960s, when we started the war on poverty, there was a concern about the people left behind in rural areas. And there was an attempt at a time when states' rights were still a very important concept, there was an attempt to justify a federal role for helping all farm workers. That did not work for many reasons. But when it came to people who migrated across state lines, the argument was that in the 1960s, many states did not provide welfare services to poor people until they had lived in the state for at least 6 months. So if a person was a migrant farm worker who started out in Texas or Florida or Southern California and migrated north with the harvest, he or she might never be entitled to services because they would not satisfy the residence requirement where they lived, since they were gone part of the time, nor any of the places in which they worked. So the federal government established programs to assist migrant workers in the 1960s when most migrant workers were white and black U.S. citizens. Over the years, those U.S. citizen farm workers have drifted out of the migrant farm workforce and into the non-farm workforce, and today most farm workers and most migrant farm workers are immigrants who are not U.S. citizens. The best guesses now are that about 80% of U.S. farm workers are immigrants. About 20% are U.S. citizens. And of those who are immigrants, the majority are not authorized to work in the United States. So the rough composition is that 80% are immigrants, 20% U.S. citizens, and most of the immigrants are not authorized to be in the United States and work.
Okay, so over 40% of the people who do farm work are not authorized to be here.
It's closer to 50%.
Wow, okay. And is this group fairly constant, or does the constitution of the group change? In other words, is it 50% more or less at all times that are illegal immigrants, and it's the same 50%, that is, they live here, although illegally, or is it an influx and outflow of different people making up that 50%? Does that question make sense?
Well, let's turn the question around a little. No American boy or girl, very few American boys and girls, dream of growing up to be migrant farm workers. The migrant workforce of tomorrow is growing up today outside the United States. Children in a field that's marked by lots of controversy, the one point of agreement is that the children of migrant farm workers, educated in the United States, do not follow their parents into the fields. Therefore, migrants come almost exclusively from outside the United States. Once they're here, they tend not to stay as a migrant farm worker. Migrant farm work is not on a list of 400 U.S. occupations. Migrant farm worker is almost always at 398 or 397. It is usually near the bottom, precisely because it requires travel. It requires relatively hard work, usually outside, for relatively low hourly earnings and relatively low annual earnings. So it's easy to understand why the average career of a migrant farm worker is typically under 10 years. And that means every 10 years, the United States has to completely replace the migrant workforce. Every year, about 10% of the people who did farm work the year before leave, and therefore there's a need to find new workers to replace them.
Okay, that in fact is going to be the source of some interesting discussion later on the show, but I'd like to get a little more just background information, though I think you've certainly given some of these answers already. You say that people tend to stay fewer than 10 years in migrant farm work. Is it a lot fewer than 10 years? Is 10 years the average?
The hard part about generalizing about migrant farm workers is exactly the same about generalizing in anything with agriculture. The United States has 2 million farms, and most of them are small, money-losing operations. But the largest 100,000 farms produce two-thirds of all the output. Now, we can get an average farm, but that average farm does not reflect the large farms that produce most of U.S. agricultural output, or the very small operations that lose money farming. And the same is true with farm workers. There are people employed year-round for wages on farms, tending livestock, or working year-round on some of the larger crop farms, operating equipment in the summer months and repairing that equipment in the winter months. There are also people employed on farms for wages very short times, a few days to a few weeks. If we add that all up, we can get an average. But we have to always remember that in agriculture, the individuals, the operations, tend to be grouped at the two extremes between the people who work almost year-round and the people who work only a very little bit. And so we have to be very careful talking about averages. But it's safe to say that most farm workers and most immigrant farm workers are young men. And the stereotypical farm worker in 2000 is a 28-year-old man born in Mexico who's in the United States without his family, who's employed in agriculture about half the year, who works about 1,000 hours while he's employed in the United States in agriculture and earns between $5 and $8 an hour, therefore has annual earnings of $5,000 to $8,000 from employment in U.S. agriculture.
Would it also be fair to say, well, let me just ask, I mean, where do most migrant farm workers work? I mean, you said they're originally from Mexico, by the overwhelming majority. Where do most work? California?
Oh, the migrants work, and farm workers generally work, where the agricultural production is. California produces about 40% of U.S. fruits, vegetables, and horticultural specialties, things like mushrooms, nursery products, and has about 40% of the U.S. farm workforce. Florida comes second, that's about 10%. And then come three or four states that each have 4 or 5%, North Carolina, Texas, state of Washington. And after that, most U.S. states have somewhere in the order of 2 or 3% of U.S. production of labor-intensive commodities.
Okay, you said that 80% of all farm workers were migrant workers. Is that pretty well evenly distributed across all these states, or at least the two big states, or do they tend to be concentrated more percentage-wise in some states than in others?
What one has to do is be very careful about now the definition or the use of migrant. When we think of migrants, we think of grapes of wrath, and we often think of people getting in their car, driving into the off following the sun, not knowing if they're going to have a job when they get there. That is rare. Instead, most immigrant farm workers enter the United States from homes in Mexico, sometimes legally, sometimes illegally. But once they get to the United States, they tend to stay in just one area. So once they're in Fresno or in southern Florida, they do not continue migrating. There's a lot of reasons for that. It's hard to find temporary housing. You really don't know if there's going to be employment or housing available if you move to a new area. So it's true that there might that many or most farm workers are migrants in the sense that they were born in another country, but it's not true that they are migrants in the sense that they are moving from Florida to Georgia to and up the eastern seaboard. Some do, but most do not.
But actually, that's very helpful clarification. But for example, would roughly the same number percentage of farm workers in California and in Florida be migrants?
The percentages tend to be relatively similar across states. In general, a higher percentage of farm workers are migrants as you move north in the United States. So generally, the state of Washington, the state of Michigan, New York will have a higher percentage of migrants than Florida, Texas, or California.
Okay.
So it's a south to north movement, and because there are not jobs for people in the northern states as many months of the year, then typically there will be more migrants in those states because they draw people in.
All right, let me pause just for a moment. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Philip Martin, professor of agriculture and resource economics at the University of California, Davis, and we're discussing migrant workers. What I'd like to do in the last less than half the show is begin to talk about decisions about migrant workers, policies, benefits, and perhaps drawbacks of migrant work. Seems to me the place to begin, though, really builds on two things that you said in the first half of the show, two very interesting bits of information. One is that 80% of all farm workers in the United States are migrants. And secondly, that the career of the average migrant worker is less than 10 years. That would indicate that roughly 40% of the farm workers have to be replaced every 10 years from people coming into the country.
That's right.
And when seen in that way, there is a substantial concern and pressure about illegal immigrants in this country that you hear in the popular press. And yet, given these figures, it looks like it would be impossible for us, the repercussions of completely shutting down illegal immigrants would be devastating to our economy.
Well, there we have to be careful. The U.S. economy is $8 trillion. All farm sales together are about $200 billion. It's important, but it's about how much the U.S. economy grows in several weeks. So if all of agriculture, that is all of agriculture, that's dependent on migrants and that's not dependent on migrants, disappeared, it would certainly hurt individuals and regions of the country. But there are a lot of very rich countries in the world, including Singapore, that don't have agriculture. They import food, and they have a per capita income not quite as high as the United States, but still relatively high. So it's very important to distinguish effects that are devastating for individuals versus effects that are devastating for the entire large and complex U.S. economy. In the case of immigrant labor and agriculture, the important point to keep in mind is that the United States has gone from an economy in which 90% of Americans worked on farms to an economy in which 2% of people worked on farms, not by finding replacements to go out into the fields after people left for the factories, but by figuring out how to get farm work done using machines instead of people. In fact, one shorthand indicator of the level of economic development of a country is what percentage of the workforce is employed in agriculture. And as the percentage of the workforce employed in agriculture goes down, we often say the country is getting more developed. Therefore, when we look at what would happen if there were fewer migrant workers, or if that 10% who leaves every year is not replaced, we have to remember U.S. history. And U.S. history is that invention or necessity is the mother of invention. When the workers aren't there, we figure out how to get things done with fewer people. And most economists looking at migrant labor and agriculture stress that if migrants weren't there, they would then wages would probably rise, and rising wages would in turn encourage farmers to develop other ways of getting farm work done.
I mean, it does seem to me though that there are some sorts of jobs that it's going to be difficult to find machines to do them in the farming industry. And, of course, rising wages does also mean that the cost to consumers are going to go up, which will have ripple effects in the economy.
Well, and once again, most of what we hear about labor and agriculture has a grain of truth, but it's very important that we not take something which is partially true and blow it up as if this is going to be a much bigger issue than it really is. In 1964, the United States stopped importing legal Mexican workers. They were called braceros. The program had been going between 1942 and 1964, and the program got larger, lasted longer than anyone expected. At the end of the bracero program, about 80% of the tomatoes picked in California were picked by braceros. And the people closest to the tomato industry uniformly predicted, without Mexican workers, the United States will not be producing the tomatoes that are used to make ketchup and pizza sauce, etc. What in fact happened? Today we produce 5 times more tomatoes than we did in 1964, and we produce them at about one-third the cost in 1964. In other words, just as historically, when young men came back from World War I and said, I don't want to live on the farm anymore, I've seen the bright lights of Paris, we wound up figuring out how to get the fields plowed, the cows milked with fewer people. It doesn't mean it's an easy process. It's a difficult process. But the engineers say there is a way to reduce by 80 to 90% much of the work still done by migrants. In the 1960s, it was predicted, remember, farm wages went up 40% in 1 year when Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers called a strike in 1966. It succeeded in part because there were not bracero workers available to replace the strikers. And the expectation was that there would be this big wave of labor-saving changes. It's sometimes not hard, not always easy to see. It's never an easy process. And it sometimes requires lots of institutional changes, which, it should be emphasized, do leave some people worse off. It's not as if everyone benefits from the changes that occur in agriculture. But the history is that when there is a lack of labor, as manifested by higher wages, there is an adjustment process, and agriculture today produces far more than it did 35 years ago. As for what it would do to food prices, the average family in the United States spends about 8% of its disposable income on food eaten at home. Included in that is about $5 a week on fresh fruits and vegetables. So spending on fruits and vegetables by the average household in the United States is relatively small. Farmers only get about $2 of that $5. Farm workers per week, farm workers get about 75 cents. So it is true that the average family saves some money because immigrant workers or migrant workers lower the cost of lettuce or strawberries. But the amount of the savings is fairly small. In the case of strawberries, it's been estimated to be a little less than $1 per family per year, which is true. It's a savings. But the average person just does not eat that many strawberries so that they can say, I'm rich because of the savings on strawberries. It's very important in thinking about the very hard trade-offs in the migration area. It's a trade-off between we want low food prices. We also want decent wages and working conditions for workers. And that's a trade-off between two goods. The one good is the low prices. The other good is the high wages and working conditions. But in thinking through what the correct trade-off should be, it's important to keep in perspective exactly what the numbers involved are. And the surprise to a lot of people when they actually look at the numbers is that the amounts are much smaller than we typically assume. We spend far more, the average household spends far more in a typical week on movie tickets than they do on fresh fruits and vegetables. So it's true, but it's not a huge amount of money, primarily because the incomes of American households have gone up, and it's true that many people are eating more fresh fruits and vegetables, but many others, for better or worse, are not.
Okay, in the last 2 minutes of the show, I wonder if you could talk about those trade-offs. If you were put in a position of trying to construct policy that would be both as beneficial as feasible to the public at large and as fair as possible to migrant farm workers, what would it be? What kind of policy would you advocate?
Well, what I have recommended in the past is that farmers, the reality is that farmers employ primarily immigrant workers from abroad. The arguments in Washington are always, what terms should farmers satisfy in order to get those immigrant workers? I would make it easier for farmers to get those immigrant workers because I think they're the workers who are going to go out in the fields and do the work. But I would charge farmers for that privilege of bringing in immigrant workers. And I would use that money that's collected from farmers to help U.S. citizen workers who are trying to get out of agriculture, but also to help farmers, many of whom can't fund the research that's needed in order to transform the way they produce commodities. And so to help farmers to make that transition to a different kind of agriculture. That's what the United States did in the past, and I think that's what the United States could and should do in the 21st century.
So, again, a combination of financial assistance for non-migrant workers who are citizens and help to farmers.
That's right. You could help both and wind up putting the industry on the trajectory it has to be on to compete in the 21st century.
Okay. Well, I hate to say it, we're out of time. This has been certainly most enlightening for me. I appreciate your appearing on the show today.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
I've been speaking today with Philip Martin, professor of agricultural and resource economics at the University of California, Davis. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.